someone will call us up and say, hey, my friend works at this Pizza Hut and this fucking Nazi works there and he's always fucking with her. And so we would go to the Pizza Hut. We would wait there, and when they get off work, we'd follow them home and then follow them to another home. And then we'd stake that place out and we'd just start making connections. All of a sudden we had this network that's all scribbled out on a notepad that had like 20 different addresses on it with the major, major hitters on their side. All the Youth of Hitler guys, Aryan Front, American Front. We had all these people's names and addresses just from following people around because we were patient. Our Friday nights would be, okay, four of us get together and we go sit out in front of the house, drink a couple beers and talk shit and listen to music and, oh, someone's coming, here they go. Okay, let's follow them to the next house. And then when they're going to try and meet up somewhere, we can dismantle their cars so they can't get there and make it really difficult for them to organize.
This is Jason from Portland's chapter of Anti-Racist Action.
The week before they were all supposed to go to Aryan Nations, we just grab a bunch of Jolly Ranchers and go from house to house to house, put them in gas tanks so that they all had car trouble and they all had to pay a mechanics bill so that they didn't have as much income to take off for the weekend. We were willing to do a lot of things that a lot of the other groups would not do, or they didn't want to risk the physical scenario, much less getting caught and then having to answer to the police. We are totally willing to do this, and we'll do it so you don't have to. I'm a white male. I'm going to make myself a target.
I picked that clip. I just love, like, Jason's just joy in hanging out with friends and fucking with Nazis and putting Jolly Ranchers in their gas tanks and just, like, these things that I'm sure were, you know, frightening and... But there is just such camaraderie and joy in that piece. And a lot of what we hear in the whole podcast with the camaraderie and joy is through a lot of the violence, which I think Jason also participated in. But it's just like, here's an example of it where you can really hear it in his voice, which is also just a strength of the podcast, is these people speaking for themselves. About the joy of resistance.
Receive letters from my nephew Mulugeta Srau. I'm from one of my brothers letting me know that they had graduated from high school and wanted to come to the US to further their education. By then, I had met and befriended a very kind couple, Clarence and Elsie Tupper, who lived in Goldendale, Washington. They were willing to sponsor Mulugeta and my brother. I sent Mulugeta and my brother I-20s, that's International College Acceptance Letters. Mulugeta completed the process and arrived in Portland in December 1980. I cannot explain the happiness we both felt when I picked him up at the airport. We had not seen each other since Mulugeta was a small boy. I marveled at how he had grown up into a handsome young man. You see, Mulugeta and I have always had a special bond. He was the second child and the first son of my beloved older sister, Fatanesh Brahanu. She was the person I loved more than anyone else because she cared for my younger siblings and me when our young mother died. Unfortunately, she died at a young age too. I felt it was my turn to help her children now. I was happy to have the opportunity to help Mulugeta. Mulugeta moved in with me in my apartment in Beaverton, and he proved to be a very responsible young man. He quickly found a job at first at a fast food restaurant, later at a small Catholic school in Beaverton. He became a favorite of both the students and the staff, the teachers. He was hardworking, caring, kind, and respectful. He also made a circle of friends among the small community of Ethiopians and Americans alike. He quickly was acknowledged as a leader and a peacemaker. He was also an avid soccer player. When I decided to move to California in January 1982, and suggested that he join me in my move, he politely declined. He said he liked it in Portland. He asked his friends, his job, his school. He assured me that he could take care of himself. During the following years, Mulugeta and I, my family kept in close contact. We would attend relative weddings and other major events together. He would visit my family in California frequently during the holidays, and I would visit him in Portland occasionally. In the process, he and my young daughter established a very special bond during his frequent visit. She just loved his beautiful smile and sweet personality. The last time I saw Mulugeta was during a Labor Day weekend in 1988, a couple of months before she was murdered, when we attended a relative's wedding in Walla Walla, Washington. He was very happy and is still going to school. Then I received a phone call on that fateful Sunday morning at 5 o'clock on November 13, 1988. The voice on the other end of the line said that Mulugeta was hurt in a fight early that morning. But intuitively, I knew that something had gone terribly wrong because Mulugeta was never a fighter. He always tried to stop fights. Even when he was murdered, he was not fighting, but he was trying to stop the fight between his friends and the skinheads. This selfless act demonstrates the true nature of Mulugeta's heart, even in the face of danger. My beloved Mulugeta Serao lived as a peacemaker and died as a peacemaker. Thank you.
That was Angada Berhanu, who was Mulugeta Serao's uncle. That was recorded on the 30th anniversary of his murder at a conference put on by the Urban League of Portland. And we got to use his speech to help the listeners of the podcast actually get to hear about Mulugeta as a person and not just a victim of this crime.
And that was another powerful clip.
Yeah.
Does anybody else want to weigh in, Selena or Mike?
Something that occurred to me is that during the production of the podcast, there have been a few times at which we've had to acknowledge that Mulugeta is a human being, was a human being, and was not just a victim of a racist murder. When you listen to his uncle talk, if you're an empathic, sentient being, you're going to be moved. And that's what we're talking about. We're dealing with people who are also human, but for whatever reasons, based on programming, fear, conditioning, trauma, I don't know, it's not my job to figure that out. But what I do understand is that they don't recognize the humanity of other humans. And the reason they're oriented towards white supremacy and racism and fascism is to protect their right to exist at the expense of everyone else. And that's the root of what we're dealing with. And that we have to acknowledge that, because I think there's a lot of debate around, well, free speech, and if you try to limit a person from speaking their point of view, aren't you just being fascist yourself? Sometimes liberals level that critique towards those of us who are anti-fascist and anti-racist. But we have to remember, and this is something that Marty said, one of the brothers that's interviewed in the podcast, he said, their freedom of speech denies us our right to exist.
Cindy, did you want to mention anything before we move on to the next section, I suppose?
No, I don't think so. I think Mike said it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mike. So I guess it might be redundant to ask what, is your favorite parts of the podcast and why? I mean, we went through a section of those, but were there any other parts of this podcast that you had a hard time deciding, you know, which to share today in this program.
There's so much that, you know, we interviewed people. We did about 35 interviews or something like that, mid-30s, and they're mostly around an hour. So there's a lot of wisdom and passion that we had access to. And then just like, you know, people who couldn't participate or didn't work out or, you know, so there's just a lot there. I feel like that, you know, I feel like we did a really good job in telling like a cohesive story in the 11 episodes, but now we get to kind of indulge some of the parts that we missed by doing these bonus episodes. So our first one actually came out yesterday. So it was the second half of episode 4, where we get to get in deeply into the history of the Baldies and ARA. And it was so great to just be able to be like, all, you know, like the story goes, and then they're like, and then we went to Portland to help out. And so for the sake of the big podcast and the main arc, it's like, okay, that's the moment where we need to go back to Portland. But it's great to now like get to hear all the rest of the things that those folks had to say in their experiences. So I'm really excited about that one. There's a couple more sharps that we interview. There's a couple people speaking very specifically about like the role of Maximum Rock and Roll and the Scene Reports in spreading the word, or like the role of YouTube in how racists get to youth to radicalize them. And then other folks who are doing kind of continuing this work on their own. So I'm pretty excited about those, us getting to add in more to the story at this point.
I just did the transcript for one of the bonus episodes, the bonus episode that Aaron was just mentioning. And there are some parts in there where Mike is reflecting on kind of what he's learned and kind of the more, I don't know if philosophical is the right word, but some of the deeper takeaways from his experiences having lived through this whole stuff, all of this. And I think right now, those have been my favorite. There's just so much wisdom there.
Yeah, I am often just blown away by the, there's a phrase, and I always fuck it up when I try to say it, but it's something like the result is greater than the sum of its whole or something. Y'all know what I'm talking about? We're able to do something together that none of us could have done alone. And it's a real testament to the power of a community and lived history being recognized and respected. And a desire in the community to want to understand that the stories that are parts of people's lived experience can teach us is just such a powerful resource in a world where we're so encouraged to seek external resources. You know, to seek commodities and to buy things to make us, you know, more whole. The fact that we have a living history that's, you know, not part of the dominant narrative is, I feel like it's an opportunity for us to pivot and to gain ground and to start to redirect, to continue in the process of redirecting things towards a more just world.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to just bring back up like the whole of us is like Mike and Selena and I like produced it and did a lot of stuff kind of at the beginning and the end, but Mo Baustern and Icky A did help with the narration, which was so valuable and so crucial because we, you know, we're just so in it and it's like, you know, Icky's like, we need narration. Like, what do you mean? It's all there. And then, you know, so we have this great mix, like, of people who were adjacent, and Icky grew up in the scene here and lived it. And so it was like, well, you know, when Mo was first talking to me about it, she's like, well, no one knows what Pioneer Square is outside of Portland. And it was like, oh, got it. Okay. Like, I see there's so much that I take for granted in this story. And so they were really great at not being really as deep in it. And then, of course, they got as deep in it as we did. But yeah, it's super, super valuable. And Julie Perini is our visual assets coordinator, is the modern term, but she was really great at digging through archives and finding the images. And then folks would then reach out to us and, like, give us posters and pictures. And that also was just so cool to get to just see that stuff of, like, people have just kept this because it's meaningful. And then we get to give it a more of a public platform. So yeah, we really had a great dream team of being part of putting this podcast together.
Thank you. I just got one more question for y'all before we open it up to questions from the audience. What would you like listeners to take away from the podcast?
I'm hoping that we find ways, that people find ways to get involved that they feel is really, like, where they need to be. I don't want people to be encouraged to do things that feel out of their, it's tough, you know, because there's not a lot of language for it. Like, we could say, I don't want to use the term comfort zone, because we're not trying to maintain a comfort zone, you know, but I want people to feel empowered and encouraged and inspired to challenge what's happening in a way that's right for them.
Totally. I think that's great. And I also think, like, there's, you know, a lot of people weren't here at the time. A lot of people were, you know, so it's just, I think it's really important to know the stories about where you live. So just to be able to, like, you know, now because of the 30th anniversary commemoration all around the neighborhood where Mula Geta was murdered, there's actually memorial things on top of the street signs. So there's, you know, like a signal to people that they can, like, note it. And, like, if they don't know, like, oh, now they can find out, which I think is really awesome. And this was a hard story to find out about if you don't know the people. So one of the things I'm really excited about this podcast existing is, like, now you don't actually have to know Mike or have to know these people and then know their history to be able to ask them questions. So I think that that's, I guess, not really what I want people to take away from the content, but just from the whole podcast existing is, like, this is one thing that happened in a wave of things that happened. So, you know, what was happening, you know, Enrique, you've got the Mexican Latino history in Oregon tab, you know, what was happening with the Native people here in struggling for their rights? What, you know, there's the whole thing with Emmanuel Hospital, like, check that out. You know, there's a lot of things that we can do to learn more about where we live and how the dominant culture, people in power, fuck over people who aren't in power. And if we know more about all of those struggles in the past, we can prevent harm from happening currently and help heal from harm that happened in the past. So it's up to us to know about this place that we live.
Thank you.
And for me, I mean, obviously what Mike and Aaron have said, and to piggyback off that, just the idea of community and organizing in a broad sense, creating, like, in the podcast, we hear about these kind of different groups that kind of come and work together. And I think that that is so important and is applicable to today.
Thank you all again. So now we're gonna open up to questions from the audience here. So please type your questions in the chat and we'll let you guys answer them.
What do you want people to take away from it, Enrique, as a listener?
As a listener? Well, I mean, it was a great story. I mean, and you guys said it yourselves pretty well. But I think it is important for people to know the history of the place that they're currently occupying. I mean, that's part of the reason that we do a land acknowledgement at the beginning of our programs, is so that we, you know, pay respects to those who've come before us, you know, whose lands we're on. And then knowing the local history of the folks who live here. I mean, Portland's, Oregon in itself is not a very diverse part of the country. And it's getting to be, you know, through the time and whatnot. And so there's a lot of history. There, you know, there's personally growing up, I experienced a lot of xenophobia. You know, I came up about the tail end of, you know, when Nazism was big in Oregon. I didn't really see a lot of that. I remember there was some, you know, here and there, but by that scene had died out by the time I was coming of age. But there was still a lot of like racism, you know, structurally and stuff like that. So I think these sort of programs and these you know, like the podcasts are important so that people can know. I mean, if you haven't experienced it yourself, you can, you know, if you have empathy, you can feel through what's being expressed in these and hopefully learn from that. I see a lot of questions coming in now, so.
I just wanted to address that first question that came up about how did ARA spread to different cities? In the beginning, you know, us in Minneapolis started the organization, the network of anti-racist action. It stemmed from the Baldies, which was an anti-racist skinhead crew that were actively engaged in confronting and fighting against the white knights, our opposition. The white knights were organized by the Ku Klux Klan. While we were doing that work, we got wind not only through commercial media, but through underground networks of communication like Maximum Rock and Roll, okay, that had scene reports where they would talk about different punk scenes in different cities. We got word that other cities were also facing Nazi problems. And so we reached out to the closest cities in our region. Me being from Chicago originally, I was going back and forth between Minneapolis and Chicago. And so I established relationships very intentionally with Black skinheads and anti-racist skinheads in a crew called Skinheads of Chicago. And that first meeting we had in 86, 87, it's so hard for me to pinpoint the year, but we had over 100 anti-racist skinhead crews, primarily from the Midwest. And that was the impetus, that was the catalyst. And from there it went on, and people would travel and start chapters, or people would find out through word of mouth or through some print literature, and they would start chapters in their own city.
Yeah, I think the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee was also doing a lot of work tying people together, mm-hmm. Along with, you know, just another network of that.
We've got another question from, and excuse me if I don't say your name correctly, Nakia Soljor. What has this work taught you about yourself? Any insights you've encountered as you engaged in these conversations? And then they express that this is a purposely broad question.
For me, I think this is the largest project that I've ever been involved in. So, and as kind of the, you know, the tentacles reached out to all the, you know, more and more places, like I've learned a lot just about organization and how you actually pull something like this off, which is, you know, most of the podcasts you hear, like at the end of it, they're like, And thanks to our 5 editors, and thanks to our 4 producers, and our 17 reporters, and blah, 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 blah. And there was really, you know, not that many of us doing this work. So I really learned a lot about the behind the scenes stuff. And with regards to the content, I don't know if it's necessarily taught me anything, but it's definitely made me like much more vocal about that there is a place for everybody in this fight, and that we have to be really engaged in it.
Living this life has forced me to acknowledge that I have a lot of PTSD. There's aspects of that that I wish I didn't have to face, because it's not like something that sits in a neatly arranged package that you pull out when you choose to. It's something that comes up when it decides to come up. But that the light side, that's the shadow side, I think, internally, you know. The light side of that education is that I became situationally aware. And that leads into the concern about, you know, how do you feel? How safe do you feel? The being involved in what I was involved in taught me how to feel safe wherever I go. Even in danger, it's almost as if I feel, when I'm forced to stand my ground, I feel more at home in that situation than a lot of people who haven't been through some of these things. The challenge with all of that is that I exist in a Black body, and that Black bodies have always been vulnerable to racial terror and hypercriminalization and stereotypes and tropes that actually get us killed. And so me standing my ground is different. I can it's easier for me to lose my life standing my ground than it is for some other people.
For me, it taught me that I love this work. I hadn't ever done anything like this before that was so collaborative and also so engaging with other people. Well, I guess that's not entirely true because I take photos of people, but in a different way. And just the synergy of all the elements coming together to create something, as Mike said, greater than the sum of its parts. And if this could be like a career going forward, that would be amazing. I love this. And one thing that some of the insights I've gained are just kind of like the piece about finding my place in this struggle or battle. Because I've questioned that a lot. I feel like I'm a little closer to having that insight into myself. Thanks for that question, Nikia.
Yeah.
And again, a big thanks to all of you for the podcast, for all the work that you put together. It was a wonderful project, and I'm honored to be able to present this to the public, you know, through the library. And now I have to go into my library things, right? So folks, I'm going to be in the chat putting a survey for the event. We ask that you if you can take time to fill that out, it'll really help us know what kind of events that we'll have in the future, so we can, continue to have events like this one.
Now, I'll go ahead.
Words?
I was going to say we're scheduled for 6 to 8, but the half hour. So are we ending now, or are we going till 8?
Well, we can go as long as you want, but maybe I'm just confused. Sorry.
No worries.
I have a schedule till 8:02, and I did see that there's another question in the chat from Sonia. I can read that. How's learning about this history impacted how safe you feel in Portland? And Mike, you kind of talked about that. Do you want to expand on that at all?
Well, you know, there's a, thanks, Selena, and thanks for the question, Sonia. Safety is such a moving target, right? I've lived next to a racist neighbor who terrorized my family and threatened to blow my head off. You know, there are people in the audience tonight who came and did house defense for me. Thank you. You know, seriously. People who sat in their cars, drank coffee. Because this man had been shooting his gun inside of his house and threatening to blow my head off. At the time I had my small daughter, you know, 3-4 years old, my 92-year-old grandma living in my home. And I didn't want to call the police, right? Because for a lot of reasons. But I understood that something had to be done. So some neighbors overheard this man threatening to blow my head off and they called the police. So one night I went out and talked to the police as they were in front of the house taking notes. And I said, hey, this man has threatened to shoot me. He's fired his gun off in my home. My family heard the shot. The neighbors heard the shot. They said, yeah, we know. We heard all about it. The guy who called us told him. So it turns out this man has a history of mental health issues and is racist and has guns. All of this. And all I wanted to know was what am I within my rights to do to protect myself? At the time, I had a felony status that would prevent me from legally owning a firearm. So I didn't want to tell the police that, but I wanted to know whether he was legally within his rights to shoot a firearm after threatening to end my life. The police told me, they said, well, you cannot do anything unless he comes onto your property. At which point I look at him, I say, well, if he comes onto my property, it's too late. So I'm not, you know, safety is a matter of perspective, but because of the life I've lived, I've never felt safe, so to speak. What I do feel like is I feel like I'm aware of the level of danger that people like me face. And I'm in community with people who've also had to confront that level of danger. It's just part of existing in this society. So safety will be a measure of situational awareness and preparedness at all times.
So in the chat, Janet, excuse me if I mess up your name, Unruh, had wrote, how can I show solidarity? And they mentioned that they'd be down to sit in the car and watch a racist neighbor. But with that, how can folks show solidarity?
I just want to make sure that I'm not taking up too much airtime. But, you know, there's something happening tonight at the Justice Center. And I understand that some of us don't feel comfortable going down to be in the midst of confrontation for so many reasons, right? We understand that there's a damage from tear gas and non-lethal munitions, and there's vigilantes who drive cars into protesters, and this, that, and the other. But what I will say is, like, even if you don't want to be in the line of fire, those places are good places to meet people, you know, who have been driven to get out of their house and do something. And you can bet the majority of people who've been driven into the street in the effort to do something are going to be thinking critically. And they might be open to, if you're willing to spend some time being in relationship in a way that examines those questions. What can we do together?
I can't remember what local group has a calendar of all of the, you know, there's still protests every day, like at the Joan of Arc statue on Chavez and Gleason, I think, 3 o'clock. So every day people show up there with signs. There's people on the corner of 15th and Broadway, I think. There's some, every once in a while, I'll see people on like Knott and 33rd, and they're just like holding signs that people can honk at. If someone can remember what that events calendar is and put it in the chat, and I'll try to remember it too, but that is a place to, you know, like Mike said, like it's another place to actually meet people who are also interested in showing solidarity. And yeah, it's, you know, there's a bunch of anniversaries of police murders coming up, and there will be a bunch more people on the streets. Yes, pdxblmevents.com. Thank you. Thank you, all the four people who just looked that up for me. So again, it's a real chance for us to meet people that we don't know and create community.
The best way to go about this work is seeing it as a marathon on building community. And I talked about this in the latest bonus episode. One of the things that made the work effective was because we were kids who loved each other. We were all in love with each other. That was part of the youth, the experience of youth. We weren't, our jobs and our families and our obligations hadn't defined our lives yet. So love was at the core of it. That said, if you're going to interrupt, I encourage people to interrupt, but think about it before you do it. Don't rush headlong into danger. But if you do see something happening right in front of you and there are others around, before you get in the middle of it, check out who else has a problem with what's happening and see if it's a safer way to interrupt if you build with those people.
Janet just mentioned an app, and one of the things that Devin, who was one of the people that we interviewed from, I can't remember his organization, but this app is called Trepper, T-R-E-P-P-E-R, the anti-bigotry app, and it's a way to report hate crimes and... anyway, check it out. Respond to, there's a, you know, local group so you can find anti-bigotry groups, signs and symbols of bigotry, so you can check that out. Security, so how to be safe while you're doing this work. And, oh yeah, it's put together by the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. And Leonard Zeskind, who we just heard from, thanks Selena for putting this in the chat, heads up that organization.
Yeah, I just want to give another plug for the Trepper app. It allows you to report, maybe you said this, Aaron, I'm sorry, I was typing the other stuff in, but it allows you to report racist things that you see around. So they use that to document and find out where these movements are happening. So that's kind of like the research piece that you can help with.
All right, are there any more questions out there?
Study history. None of this stuff is new. Having perspective that can inform critical thinking and analysis is helpful. Train your body, train your mind, and train with others. Train can be broad, firearms, martial art, cardio, whatever, but be ready. And then get together with people that you love and figure out how to do things together. Thank you all.
I typed a little question in the chat there for y'all, since, you know, this is a library event.
Settlers by Jay Sakai is an amazing book. Settlers, I'm gonna type it. Cast by, is it Wilkerson, Celine? What's her first name?
Isabel
Wilkerson.
Yeah, highly recommend that book.
What was the title to that?
Cast. The Origins of Our Discontents.
There's the Me and White Supremacy workbook that I'd mentioned earlier.
Comrade Ajamu Umi from All African People's Revolutionary Party just wrote a book specifically about organized resistance to white supremacy. Don't know the title. Go to, unfortunately, it's on Amazon, but Ajamu Umi, you'll support his work. Check, search that name, you'll find the book. Just released it.
Leonard Zeskind has a book called Blood and Politics. It's very thick and is very detailed history of white nationalism in the United States.
Ajamu's book is called A Guide for Organizing Defense Against White Supremacist, Patriarchal, and Fascist Violence.
Thank you, Erin. And here goes the link in the chat.
There's also, when we first started this, one of the folks that we interviewed gave me a book called Confronting Fascism, Discussion Documents for a Militant Movement, that was put out by ARA Chicago at the time. That was really handy to get some of the philosophy behind it. And it is, you know, it is meant to kind of be a book group book.
Oh, that's another thing. Study together, even if it's just virtual, agree to what you're reading and get together and discuss it and ask questions. Super simple. Thank you, library support, Enrique and Lindsay. And thank you all for being here. And thank you to my production team and comrades, Mo and Icky, Selena and Erin and Julie.
Thanks, everybody. This is great. Thank you, the library, always.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks to my brother and Nakia and all my other friends for coming. Hopefully I said hi to all of you in the chat.
Oh, thanks, Selena's brother.
Well, thank you all again. Sorry for jumping the gun a little earlier there. I get my times confused, and I've had a bad case of the snivels lately, so my brain is medicated with DayQuil.
Thanks for facilitating.
You're welcome.
Peace out.